Okay, so today's talk is going to be just for fun. This will be a light diversion, hopefully, from the important task of analyzing data. So this is, I will talk about the refraction effects of on neutrinos of the neutrino background. I hope to convince you that this is an interesting physics problem and give you some thoughts. So this work came out from some thoughts, some work, some thinking that we did about this problem, myself and Cecilia. This was started when I was still at the Institute. Okay, so I don't need to remind this crowd what the standard MSW effect is, but I would like to briefly answer the question, why the neutrino background? Fortunately, Ivan spoke here before me, so I think this part will be very easy. I will just refer to what she said. So everybody knows that the interactions with the background matter are important. They modify the neutrino dispersion relations. And because the interactions are flavor dependent, this plays an important role when you try to determine the neutrino flavor evolution. So the conventional cases, the case of the sun and of the earth, which are usually considered, involve refraction by the normal background. So by normal background, I mean the background of electrons and nucleons. This is the familiar case. And there are some cases, however, when you can imagine that the neutrino background also becomes important. At the zeroth order, the criterion is that there should be a lot of neutrinos. So the neutrino number density should be comparable or greater than the number density of other things. This is a very rough statement. And in this case, as I said, neutrino self-induced refraction may be important. And this is the reason why people study it. So the two cases where this is of relevance is in the early universe and in the supernova near the supernova core. So in the early universe, the number densities of neutrinos and photons are comparable. And by the early universe, I mean times before the Big Bang, before the BBM. So they are comparable, and they are greater than the density of the background baryons, and greater than the asymmetry in electron anti-electron number densities. So in this case, one has to include clearly the effect of the neutrino background. And indeed, people have done that. So for example, the studies of the evolution of the lepton chemical potential with time, and also the studies of various ideas about how lepton asymmetry can be generated through active sterile conversions before BBM, all take this refraction, neutrino self-refraction effect into account. And the second case is the supernova, where if you are not too far away from the neutrino sphere, the collision rate is small, but still the number density of neutrinos is large. And this you can estimate by simply knowing that the total energy emitted is 10 to the 53 ergs, the energy of the gravitational collapse. And it's emitted in neutrinos, and it's emitted in neutrinos with about 10 MeV energies, and the emission takes place over a few seconds. So from that, you can estimate the number density, compare with the density of other stuff, and you find that the number density of neutrinos and baryons is, the number densities are comparable. So this is, this effect also is important in the supernova. So people use that, for example, to study the R process in the supernova. Okay, so this is the motivation. Now a brief history. So the first, I think the first paper, to the best of my knowledge, to point out the importance of neutrino self-refraction in the supernova is this one by George Fuller et al. And they recognized that the neutrino background is there and it matters. And the treatment that they proposed was to treat it in analogy with the conventional MSW effect. So a brief reminder, the conventional MSW is here. This should be extremely familiar. You have neutral current interactions for all types of neutrinos and charged current interactions for the electron neutrinos. And what you do is you say, The effect of these diagrams is to take the Hamiltonian for a single neutrino and modify it by an additional term which comes from refraction. So the term is the well-known Wolfenstein term, which has 2G Fermi and E. And this extra diagram contributes for electron neutrinos, but not for other neutrinos. So there is a contribution like this. Anti-electrons contribute with the opposite sign, because the amplitude for the scattering has the opposite sign. So the attempt to construct the Hamiltonian due to the neutrino background could proceed as follows. By analogy, we have these diagrams for the neutrinos. So the only interaction that exists is the neutral current interaction. You can have this kind of scattering where the incoming neutrino comes, exchanges a Z boson with the background neutrino, and then goes away. So really, I'm drawing Z, but I'm thinking about the range of energies where this is a four fermion interaction. And the second diagram, which you can think of, is the exchange of Z, where some momentum is transferred, and the neutrino, the electron neutrino from the background, is scattered into the beam. So the neutrinos exchange momenta, and you have an electron neutrino coming and going. So this, it seems, should also be added, and the effect.
Do those graphs also include annihilation as well? new bar goes to new bar?
Well, let's see. New bar goes to new bar. Well, at the level of a four fermion interaction, you know, this is just one vertex.
The question is whether you're talking about new bar propagation. This is new E propagation.
So right now I'm looking at new E, but I can say both.
I said new plus new bar.
Right, new plus new bar. So
you've collided a new with a new there, and I was just asking whether the picture included a new bar.
Let's see.
If it's coming up later, I'll save it.
Okay, I hope to answer this later, but this is a good question. So this calculation, which is a historical review, this is not mine. So this includes these diagrams, and about new E and new E bar doing what you said, that requires some thinking. Okay, let me think about that. Okay, so anyway, so the logic is similar to what was done for the conventional MSW. You say that this is the same for all flavors, so you write something proportional to the identity. And then you have this, which is supposedly different for electron neutrinos, but not for muon neutrinos. So this comes from that diagram. Now, it turns out that things are more complicated. For active-active oscillations, things are different, qualitatively different. And the easiest way to see this is to notice that the problem has a flavor symmetry. So this was first pointed out by Jim Pantaleoni in 92. The argument goes as follows. So you take the neutral current weak interaction, and you say that, well, it's the interaction of two currents like that. And what? This problem clearly possesses a U2 flavor symmetry. You can take your states, rotate them, all the states in the beam and the background, and nothing should change. If I am just constraining myself to the neutrino-neutrino interactions and forgetting about other background matter and other vacuum terms, for example, then the problem is completely U2 symmetric. So any result should also, anything you derive from this should also obey this symmetry. Okay, so let's do this. So if the neutrino states, both in the beam and the background, everything, this is an important point, are rotated, the Hamiltonian and the new basis should be exactly the same. So this can be written like this. Suppose I have some background where the background states are new x, some linear combination of new e and new mu. Then when I rotate to the new basis, I rotate the background, and I also rotate my basis states. And if I do that, then if I rotate both the beam and the background, then things should stay exactly the same. So this is the statement of the U2 symmetry. And this, the diagonal Hamiltonian that I showed before, is not U2 invariant. It just isn't. So. Okay. So it's not invariant. And in general, as I'm going to show next, this Hamiltonian contains not only diagonal terms, but also off-diagonal terms.
This is simply not broken because of the mass of the lepton. For example, imagine that you have neutrino.
Yes.
And there's some abortions here. If you have some lepton changing here, this symmetry will not be broken because you have mass, let's say, you have loops that depend on the.
I said that I'm working in the lowest order approximation where I forget about everything else. So not only I forget about loops of heavy leptons, but I just forget about vacuum terms. So neutrino can have, you know, vacuum mass terms, which I have to forget. So if I want to write the part which is due to neutrino-neutrino interaction and not other things, and I work to the lowest order, so I don't look for these loop corrections, the problem is U2 invariant. So that is an accurate statement, but you know, it's important. It's important that you pointed this out. Yeah. Thank you. Okay. So the logic is the following. So consider new E and the new E background. Okay. One thing for sure is that neutral currents are not allowed to change flavor. So in this case, you can have this diagram, new E in the new E background, or you can have the exchange diagram. And in both cases, you have a scattering amplitude. And by analogy with the MSW, you write this for the new E entrance of the Hamiltonian. You say that it's twice because you have two diagrams. OK. What about new mu in this background? So when you have new mu, you only have this diagram, presumably.
So you never consider anti-neutrinos at any time?
So right now, I am not considering anti-neutrinos because I want to simplify it as maximally as possible to get to the essence of the thing. So I'm going to throw away all the complications, mass, anti-neutrinos, and et cetera. For now, this is to make a point. This is to make a point. So. Okay, so there is one diagram and there is this term. So if I combine everything, I get this for my Hamiltonian. So diagrams like this give me a diagonal and something proportional to the identity. And the exchange diagram here gives me this entry. Oh, and I didn't mention one important difference with respect to the normal case of refraction and stationary matter is that you have this angular factor. Simply because neutrinos, so this is the angle between the incident neutrino and the neutrino in the background. So simply because the neutrinos are relativistic, they move. If they move all parallel in the same direction, they don't see each other. So this comes when you write the four fermion interaction and you take into account the angular factor. This is a digression. Okay, so now I want to rotate my background to some state and use U2 to find the result for that. So if my background is some linear combination of new E and new mu, I can go through these steps. So the Hamiltonian for the new background can be found by taking the Hamiltonian for the E background and rotating it, and I get this. So the identity is, of course, unchanged, but this is rotated. So I get a Hamiltonian which has diagonal as well as off-diagonal terms. And if I want to do it more carefully, I can say that I can have many neutrinos in the background. I sum over all the neutrinos in the background for a given neutrino in the beam, and this is the result of the rotation. So this, I mean, this is nothing but the density matrix for the background neutrino that I found by applying the rotation procedure. So this was the point. This is an important point. So Pantaleoni made this argument, and then he conjectured. So he conjectured two things. First, that the neutrino ensemble, the bus of neutrinos, can still be described by a system of single particle equations. So a priori, this point is not clear at all. In general, this is a multi-particle problem where everything collides with everything. Maybe you form some complicated entangled states and God knows what. So he said, suppose that you can still write an equation for a single neutrino, which is what all of this was. So these are equations for a single neutrino. And then if you can do that, then the Hamiltonian has to be given by that, by the symmetry of the problem. So this was the argument. This result was later rederived by these authors, Siegel and Raffelt, and also McKellar and Thompson, who did a much more general analysis, including collisions and as well as refractions. And they used, they did it in second quantized formalism with quantum kinetic equations. And these analyses are definitely more general, but they are also less transparent. It's not clear, it's less clear, in my opinion, what is physically going on in that case. And here is a very incomplete list of applications. So this equation, this density matrix Hamiltonian that I showed, has been used as a starting point for many, many studies. So that Hamiltonian has been accepted, and people used it to study how flavor evolves in the early universe. So for example, what happens if one of the flavors has a chemical potential? Here is the list of references. I won't talk about this here. And also in the supernova core. So this has multiple applications. So the thing I would like to address now is we want to know what is physically happening behind, what is going on with the neutrinos, what is the mechanism that gives that formula. Something that we can understand hopefully from the first principles without heavy formalism or references to the symmetries or anything like that. Also, I want to know what are the physical assumptions. Is there something one needs to assume to arrive at that? I'll discuss this statement in more detail later. Okay. And then, as I said, there is a question whether the single particle approach is even justified for this problem. So let us try to make a simple-minded attempt at deriving this. So consider a maximally simplified toy problem. I have a beam of electron neutrinos, and it is traveling through another beam, which intersects it at the right angle, and the second beam is made up of neutrinos which are in a superposition of flavor states. So this is, you know, as simple as it can be. You have this beam, it intersects this beam, I put a detector here, and I measure the muon neutrino component. So supposedly some flavor transformation occurred here, and I need to know how many muon neutrinos are incident on my detector. Okay, now this problem looks very much like the FCNC problem, the problem of flavor changing neutral currents. It looks like that because the FCNC Hamiltonian, well, the Hamiltonian looks like that. It has diagonal terms and off-diagonal terms. And our density matrix also has diagonal and off-diagonal terms. So maybe the physics is just the same. So it's very tempting to use the intuition which you get from FCNC and extend it to the neutrino-neutrino case. So replace the second beam by a slab of matter, which has flavor-changing interaction properties. Ask what is the neutrino flux on this side. So the second case is very clear. It's very well understood. So usually when you have incoherent scattering, the flux of the muon neutrinos is proportional to the amplitude, the flavor conversion amplitude for a single scattering squared, times the number of scatterers. So this is very easy. If I took my detector and put it here, this is how many muon neutrinos I expect flying from this lab. Epsilon square, epsilon prime squared times n. Now, for some particular case, when the scattering is in the forward direction, all amplitudes add up. And then the flux of muon neutrinos here is epsilon squared, epsilon prime squared times n squared. So this fact that you have an n squared effect is what distinguishes refraction from incoherent scattering. So this is the essence of refraction. That's why you worry about refraction even when you neglect collisions. Okay, so the prescription is obvious. You take an elementary scattering amplitude for an electron neutrino to become a muon neutrino once as a result of a single scattering, multiply by the number of scatterers, n square, if you're looking for the coherent forward scattering. And this is indeed what you get if you study this case. Well, this you take the standard oscillation formula, that's what it is. Okay, now let's do the same for the electron neutrinos, for the neutrino-neutrino problem. So clearly, the flavor-changing interactions conserve flavor. The only way, therefore, a muon neutrino can appear on this side is if it came from this beam. So it came from here, got scattered, and went into this direction. So the origin of the flavor-changing process is shown in this transparency, in this slide. Okay, so it's good, very clear. Now for this single interaction, I can write a well-defined Hamiltonian. You know, when two electron, both neutrinos are in the electron state, then electron muon, muon electron, and muon muon. So when both are in the electron state, I have two, because I have two diagrams. When I have electron muon, I have 1, 1. So I have a probability that this state will exchange flavor and become this. And here I again have two. So if I start with the initial state nu e, nu x, and I evolve my system by a little bit, I get that my conversion probability goes like sine squared of the mixing angle. Yeah. Here, from going to here, it's sine squared of the mixing angle, which is, of course, obvious. So this, in this picture, it just tells you that you have nu x in this beam, and you ask, what is the nu mu composition of nu x? It's just sine. Okay, so for a single scattering process, the amplitude of measuring this nu x neutrino as nu mu goes like sine alpha. Now, if I go the same way I did with the flavor-changing neutral currents, I have to multiply by the number of scatterers, and then I find that the flux, total flux of nu mu, should go as sine squared alpha. But this is not what you get if you use this, if you use the density matrix. So if I use this, this is my off-diagonal term. Remember, sine squared sine cosine alpha, and with that I get. Come on. With that I get that the conversion probability goes as sine squared of 2 alpha. So, this is a very puzzling result. The reason why it is puzzling is, the flavor conversion comes about because you scatter muon neutrinos from the background into the beam. So then if I send an electron neutrino through the background of pure muon neutrinos, you would expect maximal conversion in this case, naively. But instead, this result tells me that there is exactly no conversion. So when I send electron neutrinos through a bath of pure muon neutrinos, there is no conversion. And the conversion rate is maximized when the background neutrino is in a 50-50 mixture of flavors. So when the background neutrino is nu e plus nu mu, you get a maximal conversion rate. That looks puzzling. So, okay, this looks puzzling. So our first thought was that maybe this density matrix Hamiltonian that I've written down is only valid under some physical assumptions. So once you take those assumptions, then you can understand that result. But in general, maybe it's not right. And indeed, if you read the paper, Pantaleoni actually, it's a great paper. He goes and he discusses the physics behind this. And so what he says, however, is somewhat confusing. He says that for general conditions, the flavor evolution is a many-body phenomenon. So perhaps one cannot write a single particle Hamiltonian. And then he says this, for massive neutrinos, there is some averaging that you need to do. So you need to say something about mass eigenstates in the background being incoherent. So he says the diagram's diagonal in the propagation eigenstate sum up coherently, but the exchange diagrams do not sum up coherently. So maybe once you take this assumption into account, you recover that. That's important. If there is some non-trivial assumption, the neutrino mass never came into the interaction region. Well, this is an This is an important point which I forgot to mention. So what we're considering is a problem where neutrino mass is sufficiently small that inside the interaction region, all the conversion you can say is due to the neutrino-neutrino interaction. This is an assumption that the density in the conversion region is high enough, and the neutrino mass is small enough that vacuum oscillation over that region can be neglected. But in principle, the mass exists implicitly because I'm sending mass. I'm sending flavor superpositions. So somewhere outside, I can prepare a new X, which is a flavor mixture.
Well,
it doesn't enter any of the discussion, but maybe, I don't know. Maybe you have to assume something about your background being in incoherent superposition of mass eigenstates. I don't know. This comment confused us a lot. We sent an email to the author, and he said, I'm still thinking about this. So,
1992?
This was 1992, yes. So, okay, so this got us interesting. What was further interesting is that these papers, the subsequent papers, don't mention any of such thing. No assumption like that is mentioned. Okay, additionally, there is the following point.
Well, those papers have the masses and they just do whatever they do, right?
Those papers arrive at the same results. They also have masses and they also have scattering. And they also have Pauli blocking. So in principle, those results are very, very powerful. And I don't want to say in any way that they're wrong. All I'm saying is I'm interested to understand, what physical assumptions or what is the physics behind this. And those papers have relatively heavy formalism and do not address what I would like to address here. So that's all I'm trying to say.
I was going to ask,
yes.
But many body theories are going to attack this problem. Another concept would come right at the start, and that is, what do you mean by coherent? And which has to do with how you label your single particle states.
Right.
Implicitly, in the entire discussion, I guess, assuming these are momentum eigenstates.
Yes.
But you've got an interacting system. It's not necessarily a natural.
Exactly. So this is exactly the problem. I mean, maybe your eigenstates in this system are not single particle states. Maybe you form some complicated superposition of different momenta or something like that.
It's not even a well-posed problem.
It's not a well-posed problem.
You can do a unitary transformation on your whatever the exact state and get an entirely different definition of what you mean by coherent and incoherent.
This is what we.
Suppose it's a completely non-interacting system. So you have the momentum eigenstates were the exact eigenstates.
And which are you talking about? Which beam?
Just think about this as an interaction occurring in an exact many-body eigenstate, just like you would do a many-body problem. So think of it a nucleus, a whole atom, a bunch of neutrinos, it doesn't matter. Then do a unitary rotation on the definition of those non-interacting states, and they look like interacting states as soon as you do a unitary transformation. Which is the old question, if you're going to calculate something, whether you use a Harvey-Fock basis or some other basis, what you mean by a coherent reaction, interaction changes, depending on if you're trying to write it as a one-body equation in a particular basis state, like momentum eigen state, it's going to depend on how you define that single particle state.
So if you're doing, it sort of look at sort of particle coming into a background, in any of these problems about refraction, you say, okay, there's a big collection of particles that the coherence gathering doesn't depend upon huge discussions, except for, you know, basically coherence at the very end. In describing refraction, you discuss light going through the medium, you don't say, well, then take a state of 50 million photons and 1 million atoms and try to do unitary transformations on them, you know, to do
refraction. Photon going through matter is not a good analog because that's a photon interacting with a bunch of scatterers. So photon, this is a neutrino which is not distinct from neutrinos in the wave function.
What do you mean in the wave function? In the background?
Background. They're all neutrinos. So you've got an A plus one body state.
I'll just put my vote in for Lincoln. You can do plane waves for your idealized calculation and then make any kind of wave packets you want in the end to get roughly the same result.
What you mean by elastic reaction, that's a single particle, you want to extract from that problem a single particle.
Well, in P1 and P2, there's always a possibility of one guy going P1 on conserving momentum. You don't want to see energy, you shouldn't be conserving energy here in these long time things anyway. You're studying the time development over a period of time. So
doesn't make any sense in a many body system. You can't pull out a single particle in that guy and say, this is
all I say, throw the words away, do the calculation. And
this is clearly basis dependent. This is a standard problem you do.
In any case, this is precisely what our suspicion was at this point. So our suspicion was that maybe this whole idea of writing a single particle Hamiltonian and imposing U2 symmetry is maybe not right, because
you made a categorical statement. So I'll make one. It isn't basis dependent. Okay.
So thank you for making this very stimulating.
Okay, go ahead.
Thank you for making my talk very stimulating. Okay, so another problem is, it's related to what is being discussed here right now. So another problem is that usually when you do the refraction phenomenon, when you consider the refraction phenomenon, you look for coherent scattering. And the coherent scattering is something that you assume that the scatterers are unchanged as a result. So you say it's a forward scattering, and you have several events, and the scatterers after the scattering have the same momentum as before. And in other words of saying this is that you cannot say on what particles you scattered. This is a fundamental sort of quantum mechanics statement. If you know on which particles the scattering took place, it's not coherent. But in this case, definitely the background changes, at least to conserve flavor. So what's going on? So how to take this into account? Okay. So here is the idea that we came up with. It's a very simple idea. It should be very easy to follow. So let us consider this point. What happens to the background more carefully? So consider a single neutrino in the beam, which scatters on several background neutrinos. So the scattering can be written as follows. You have a single electron neutrino which interacts with a bunch of things, with several neutrinos in the background. So there is a probability that no scattering will take place. And then there is a probability that the scattering on each of the neutrinos takes place. So there is a probability that the neutrino will be exchanged with the first neutrino in the background, second, third, and so on. So this is the simplest case where all I do is I exchange neutrinos between the beam and the background. Okay, and now that I know that this is my final state, this plus this is my final state, I need to compute the expectation value of the new mu number operator in this final state. So this operator acts, so here it is. This operator acts only on the beam, since that's what I'm doing. I'm measuring the new mu content in the beam. But all I need to do is to write the beam as well as the background when I take when I compute this quantity. So when I do that, the background states go right through the operator, but then they need to be the product needs to be taken. And this is the key point. So you have to look at what happens to your background after the transformation. When I compute this product, I have terms where a state hits itself, like this state hits this state hits it's this state, and so on. And there are clearly N2 of those, where N2 is the number of particles in the background. So I have N2, I get M2, each product is one. And then there are off-diagonal terms, so off-diagonal in some sense. So when this state is multiplied by this state, you have E and X and E, and that gives you cosine squared alpha. And there are N2 squared, the total number of terms in this product, minus M2, because this M2 went here. So this is how many off-diagonal terms there are. And this product indeed gives you sine squared alpha. So if I put all of this together, this is the expression that I find for the muon number, for the muon neutrino number. And you can see that an interesting thing happened. When I go to large N2, so for a single N2, when N2 is equal to 1, I recover my intuition about a single particle process. But when N2 goes to infinity, this term starts to dominate. This term wins. And then what I find is sine squared alpha, cosine squared alpha, which is precisely what I got from the density matrix.
If the N squared, normally we think of these things having, is this dead forward scattering?
This is dead forward scattering.
Okay, sorry.
And indeed, you know, as I said before, the coherent scattering as opposed to incoherent scattering is characterized by that, the number of particles squared. So that thing is the coherent piece. And the factor of cosine squared alpha comes about when I look at the background carefully. Okay, so lessons to this point is that an elementary scattering event changes the background. If you keep terms which go like n squared, then you are looking at the coherent piece. You drop everything which corresponds to incoherent scattering. And then you recover the result of the density matrix Hamiltonian. So there is no conversion which goes like n squared in the pure new mu background. This goes to the paradox that I raised. So if I have a pure new mu background, my final states look like this, E nu nu, nu E nu, etc. And these states are mutually orthogonal. So they have no overlap. So when I take this this product, it just vanishes. So when I have a pure new mu background, the coherent piece is exactly zero. Now, a little bit of thought can convince you that the part that is amplified coherently is when I take the changed background states and I project it on the initial background and the state which is orthogonal. So I can take my state which I get after the exchange and project this E onto the initial background state and the orthogonal part. This is the thing that will amplify coherently because it's the same for all scattering possibilities. So this will amplify coherently and this will not. This is what I see. Okay, now let us generalize this slightly. So I have two beams. Back to my original problems. I have two beams. You know, bear with me. The logic is the same. I take exchanges, all possible exchanges, and I write them like this. So any neutrino from the beam can scatter on any neutrino from the background with some amplitude. I have N1 and N2 terms in this exchange state. And then in each of these states, I project each of these states I project onto the initial background before the scattering occurred, and the orthogonal state. And then it's just a matter of writing a monstrous equation. Well, it's not that bad. So the exchange state that I wrote here, can be represented as follows. So an unchanged background and an unchanged beam here, N1 and 2, because all these things just add up, and I had N1 and 2 terms. Then I have a changed beam times the unchanged background, changed background times the unchanged beam with the appropriate projection coefficients. And then at the end, I have these guys. So this is a, you know, this last term represents a product of mutually orthogonal states. This is sort of what you have when you send an electron neutrino through the muon neutrino bath. You get a bunch of states which are mutually orthogonal. And when you compute the probability, this gives you something which is lower power in N. So this piece in blue, it represents the incoherent piece. And if I drop it and I look at the first three, an interesting thing happens. The result of this interaction can be rewritten as a product of single particle states. So if I start with single particle states and the beam and the background, and I let them interact by doing these exchanges, and I separate coherent and incoherent parts and drop the incoherent part, I find that I again have a product of single particle states, but each of these states is rotated. It's rotated by a little bit. So what I find is, indeed, I find some sort of a precession picture. So each neutrino here, as a result of many interactions, precesses, and the precession result is shown here. And this looks very close to what is predicted by the density matrix Hamiltonian. So the density matrix Hamiltonian, which is here, if I evolve my system by small time, it gives me this. So this is just the diagonal part, and the off-diagonal parts are here. This should be very easy to see. And then I can compare this and this. So what I find is that this is sine cosine, the two projections. This quantity is a cosine squared. And then there is one difference, one important difference. The important difference that here I have a factor of a half, and here I don't. So the results look the same, but not exactly the same. And this factor of a half is there because this term, which represents the state which is unchanged, needed to be split between all of these states.
I think if you check this, you'll find that that is the what you've done is diagonalize the one-body density matrix in this background. So you'd actually define the best basis, the best single particle basis, by diagonalizing the one-body density matrix. So you took the scattering amplitude between x prime and e prime, you should find some orthogonal between x prime and e prime.
Say that again. I missed that.
What I think you've done is you've got an interaction that looks like it'll perform a dagger a scattering.
Yes.
And you've chosen a basis such that a dagger a is diagonal. So you can just think about that operator a dagger a between my two body bases. And now I do a rotation to the single particle basis that allows me to diagonalize the one body density matrix. So the original basis is a dagger a. The expectation that I could get electron muon contributions. You've done a rotation to diagonalize that matrix, and those are the single particle states that diagonalize that. I bet you, if you work it out, that's what you find.
Okay, that's a good suggestion.
Most of the many body guys do is when they have no other way of defining a single particle basis, and the best basis is the one that diagonalizes the one body density matrix.
Okay, thank you.
I'm not sure exactly, but I mean, what happens in this case, as far as I can see, if the background
is exactly the same state as the incident state, then nothing can change because it's the same state. And if the background state is orthogonal to the incident state, I mean, the basis states for transmission through some background state is the background state. There's the one part of the state that's equivalent to the background state. And that state is sort of an eigenstate of transmission. So
you get, I think that there's no distinction between the background and the neutrino that's coming in.
Well, the state is. You can define the neutrino coming in as all new E, and the background as being half a coherent new E plus new mu. The beam coming in can be new E plus new mu in the background.
I think even if you have a neutrino well separated from your background to come into your background, in some technical sense, you can imagine that entire problem is being an A-body problem. And so if you can separate it out to infinity, one guy, but it's still an interacting system. So there's never, because there's always an A-dagger, A-dagger, A-A interaction. If there's nothing that ever diagonalizes anything, it's in the form of A-dagger, A.
So there's a transmission matrix. You start out. Here you have something, it's like S matrix theory, you have its initial state, eventually comes out as a final state, and so it's and there's something happened in between. And so eventually defined by the transmission matrix.
You guys want to talk about physics, but let me talk about equations. Back to the density matrix, you can define it either basis, any basis you want, the flavor basis, the mass eigenvector, vacuum mass eigenbasis, you can write an equation of motion, Heisenberg equation of motion for this density matrix by taking the commutator. Now, you faced that problem a little bit before. You take that commutator and there are loops that you can, I mean, it's field theory, so you can, there's vacuum stuff that you have to throw away. So it's a little bit arbitrary, but the thing is that you get a expression for a density matrix, evolution in time, and then you can take whatever matrix elements of that you want, and take whatever initial state you want, you pick whatever final state you want to say how you go from here to here in time. And there isn't any ambiguity about how the states are defined, it's just one basis versus another, but the Heisenberg equation of motion is invariant under that change of basis, and that's all that's used for, allegedly, for the two references that you quoted, Raphael and Sigal and McKellar and Thompson.
Yeah, that's right. Well, okay, anyway, so this is, back to this, there is an interesting discrepancy between the standard Hamiltonian and what we find by our exchanges, and let's see what is the origin of this discrepancy and does this have any physical implications. So the origin of this discrepancy, as I said, that the state N1 and 2 in that product needed to be split between the single particle rotated states. So if I write this, if I wrote this, the rotated states being given by the density matrix, that gives the factor of 2 in front of this term. So what this comes down to is the overcounting of the interaction energy. So if you can, the easiest case is if you have all electron neutrinos, then all you have is just some change in the interaction energy, some shift, because neutrinos interact. But the interaction energy belongs to a pair of neutrinos. So when you write a single particle equation for each neutrino, and you take this term and you give it to each particle, you are overcounting the total energy by a factor of 2. So that is the origin of this discrepancy. And now the question is, does this have any physical effect? Okay, so to do that, we need the evolution equation which takes this discrepancy into account. So what we've got up to this point is the evolution for small t. So for small t, I can rewrite my results, my rotation of a single particle as follows. So I have this, and here I have two terms. The first term is the beam neutrino is acted upon by the density matrix of the background. This is the standard case. And because of this overcounting argument that I gave you, there should be an additional piece where you have this product. So this just follows from this from the equations that I showed before. The important point that this was done for small delta t, and I said that initial neutrino was an electron neutrino and so on. But really, this doesn't, all I used were exchanges, and there is no reference to any particular basis. So therefore, this equation is valid. Now there is a delta t missing here. Not good. This equation is valid for all times. At any time, this equation is valid. And therefore, this is really a differential equation, which you can write. So the differential equation that we get is something like this. So this is the standard piece. And then there is this strange additional piece which arises because you try not to overcount the energy. This equation is also U2 invariant, by the way. So if you just use the U2 arguments, you could as well have written this. Okay, so what does this mean? So it turns out that this phase, this additional term, gives you an overall energy shift for all your energy levels in the system, and it does not affect the flavor evolution, fortunately. So this equation, I can write it in this schematic form as something like this. So I have some Hamiltonian which acts on psi, and then I have some additional piece which is proportional to the identity matrix. Okay, so this is the form of the equation. And if I know the solution to this equation, if I have some psi naught which solves this equation is solved by that. So psi naught times something which is a pure phase. If you can, you can check that this indeed solves this equation, provided psi naught is the solution of the original equation. So all this can be said simply that the flavor evolution goes according to the standard Hamiltonian, and the additional term which comes from the energy overcounting argument gives an overall energy shift to all levels in the system. This energy shift, by the way, depends on the relative angle between the beam and the background neutrinos. So if you represent your beam and background states as in flavor space, then this interaction energy is proportional to the cosine squared of the relative angle. And, you know, as I said, this is a phase. So can one think of some other way to probe this phase? So the phase is there because there is some interaction energy between the neutrinos. And so what the first impulse one might have, okay, the first impulse that I had was to try to probe this phase by constructing some superposition state where you can make part of your state interact with the system and the second part not to interact with the system. Then the standard logic goes that here you will get a phase, here you will not get a phase, and then as a result of the interference, this phase will have some physics effect. So this case, so what I'm coming to is the active sterile oscillations, because this scheme looks precisely like what you would get in the active sterile oscillation. So turns out that, you know, this intuition is wrong, and in the active sterile case, this extra term is also a phase. So to see this, consider the standard Hamiltonian for the active sterile neutrinos. So you have this term times M2 times cosine squared alpha, which counts the number density of electron neutrinos, active neutrinos in the background. This could be written as follows in the symbolic form. And if we repeat the same game that we did for active-active by doing the exchanges, we get a Hamiltonian which looks like this. So this piece is the same as the standard piece. And this is an additional interaction. This is an additional piece similar to what I found before for the active-active. So this equation is solved in the same way the previous equation was solved. And this also gives an additional phase, an overall phase for all states. And the reason why the naive argument before failed is that this equation is nonlinear. So it is not, it involves projection of the z state on E. Okay, to put the story short, this term is nonlinear. It measures the active component in this superposition state. And so this intuition, which is there because we are used to dealing with linear interference problems, simply does not work. Okay, now the last point that I want to mention is whether this extra term ever becomes important. Or in other words, under what assumptions this is an overall phase. So it turns out that the assumption that this is an overall phase and has no physical effect is that you have your background is in the state which is a product of single particle states. So if you consider to argue that this is the assumption, I'm going to consider the artificial case where the background is in a quantum superposition of some states. Then, so let me say that the background is in this state somehow. So my neutrinos are either all in one flavor state or all in the other flavor state, and I consider this quantum superposition. This is not the same as saying that each neutrino is in a superposition of flavor states. This is different. And you know, since we have this exchanges method, the problem is well defined even for this.
It's a large number. Since it's large n, it's a very entangled state.
Oh yes. So there is no.
You know how to make such a state?
No. That's the thing. I mean, if I knew this, then I wouldn't make statements that the phase is always a phase. So if I had this state, if I made it somehow, so this is just used to illustrate the idea that if you have a state which is hopelessly entangled like this, then you get physical effects. So it's not clear how you do it with the standard density matrix formalism if your state is something like this. But it's very clear what to do if you use the exchanges. So you simply take the beam, interact it with the linear superposition, and by interaction I mean doing exchanges the way we did exchanges before. In the end, you find states of this form. So you get that E interacted with X, and you get some phase for that. And E interacted with Y, and you get some phase for that. And remember that this phase was dependent on the relative angle between E and Y. So this phase is different with respect to that. And you know, this phase, there is a relative phase, and this has a physical effect. But so if you computed the expectation value of, say, mu on number operator, you would find some interesting effect.
In the case of new Eunostera, if you also have some oscillation going on, it still doesn't matter. I mean, there's a mass difference, and so you have that superimposed on the equation.
So the argument is that the argument is this: that if you have some Hamiltonian, which does not include this piece, which is proportional to the identity, this guy could include vacuum masses also. It could. I mean, so if this solves the original Hamiltonian, this term gives you an additional phase, a phase shift. So the conclusions are here. So we consider the new refraction problem, and somehow we are able to derive this result from it's conceptually very simple argument. It's a little tedious to write many symbols, but conceptually this is very simple. So you just have an interference effect once you properly include the change in the background state. We made no special assumptions about decoherence between certain states and so on. So the equation should be applicable. So these worries that maybe you require some incoherence in the background between mass eigenstates, they are not necessary. It's not necessary to assume anything like that. And although we found that the standard formalism overcounts the neutrino interaction energy, this overcounting has no effect on the flavor evolution. So the correct equation gives an overall energy shift for all energy levels, for both active-active and active-sterile oscillations. And under normal conditions, where normal conditions is what I tried to define, the oscillation physics is not affected by this. Thank you. So first, you know, before I forget, I have to answer your question in the beginning. So of course, there are new E bar diagrams, which are included.
Yeah,
they are included in that Hamiltonian, because you take density of new E and you subtract the density of new E bar.
I agree completely.
It was beginning of the talk, so my brain was sleeping.
Just went on the picture.
Yeah.
Well, my question was going to be, so I gathered that you're not correct, you're not changing the equations that Yvonne used.
No. We're saying that all those equations are give you correct results.
Okay.
So the conclusion is, if you just want the bottom line, it's safe.
Okay.
It's safe.
Well, I have a question.
Yeah.
When you're studying neutrino oscillations, it's routine to throw out terms in the Hamiltonian which are proportional to the identity.
Right.
Because you know that one of the
right.
flavor
right.
So now you found an additional term.
Which should be thrown out.
Okay, so but then there are other terms that may be thrown out along the way in the calculation. Are you sure that all terms have been kept throughout the calculation, and so this additional term that you found isn't actually cancelled by some term that has been thrown away before?
Well, this term comes about. So let me try to say something. I will see if this leads somewhere. So this term comes about when I only consider exchanges. So when I only consider exchanges, I have some piece which is proportional to the identity. There is also a shift when you have diagonal process, when, as I said, new E comes and it sends a Z to the other neutrino and then goes. So there are those diagrams. They give an additional phase shift. So if you want the total phase shift, it's that plus this piece which I found from the exchange diagram. So all I can say is yes, this piece joins the collection of things which don't matter for oscillations, and this is the piece that comes from the exchange diagram. If you include other things like the overall mass shift, there will be another shift for all states. And I don't see how those additional shifts could affect this shift.
So those additional shifts in the non-exchange diagrams are somehow more, say, straightforward in the method of interpretation, because they just depend on the total amount of neutrinos we have in the background. But this term was sort of tricky because it depends on the relative orientation of the beam neutrino and the background neutrino. So in principle, this term depends on your states, both of the beam and of the background, and that's why in ideal situations like the entangled background, they could give some physical effect.
In the isotropic case, is that term there?
In the
early universe case?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. If you have some way of taking a ball of neutrinos and saying that the interaction energy of this ball is something, you know, some number, and you could measure this interaction energy, the absolute energy, then this term would be there. Because in the standard formalism, you write this interaction energy twice. For each neutrino, you give this energy. You can actually look at the paper by Siegel and Raffelt where they go from their formalism to a single particle formalism, and it looks just like a mistake. They just read off a single particle equation from what they get from multi-particle, from the second quantization. The second quantization result is, of course, correct. But when they go to a single particle, they sort of have this jump.
So, but if it's symmetric between neutrinos and antineutrinos, it doesn't cancel the energy shift? If I have a bath of completely symmetric between neutrinos and antineutrinos.
Okay, that is a good question. Maybe it cancels.
Now let me say something about that. In the Siegel and Raffelt equations,
the only in the equations Yvonne used, there's always a neutrino minus an antineutrino. It depends entirely on the difference between the antineutrino and antineutrino in any flavor state, or for that matter, in any off-diagonal term. So neutrinos equal antineutrino, identically zero for making happen.
So the amplitudes have opposite signs, fundamentally. So if you get an additional term from one, an additional term from the other, they cancel. If you have some, you know, situation like in supernova when the flavors are not equal, then...
I haven't read this paper, mainly Wilson. Does anybody have any experimental consequences of this sort of effect? Or is this mainly the interacting on the repellent neutrinos?
Oh, yeah.
What are the consequences?
So one thing what Yvonne talked about here, Yvonne Wong talked about here in the beginning of the program. There was a lot of work on flavor equilibration in the early universe. So suppose you have one of the flavors has a chemical potential. How can you constrain that? So normally you say there is a constraint for electron neutrinos, which is very strong because they their presence matters for BBN directly. And there is a weaker constraint on mu and tau because that just contributes to the overall expansion rate of the universe. But that's all. They don't enter the reactions. But if you have oscillations which convert mu into electron neutrinos, then you cannot just put a large chemical potential in the muon without it showing up in the electron flavor before BBN. So this is used to constrain the chemical potential for mu and tau neutrinos.
And how about the supernova case? Is there any?
The supernova case.
A lot of oscillation, neutrino oscillation.
Yeah. This whole thing started with the supernova. So we were not thinking about that. We were thinking about supernova.
There are lots of other things that happen, so you can do the whole story.
Yeah. So
if George were here, he'd make a statement about whether or not it matters for supernova, and I gather it might.
You have to put
all sorts of other things in, and then you have to ask the computer what came out, and you're not sure.
Supernova experimentally, the only way we tag flavor is by energy.
Right.
Well, we can see the electron neutrinos, but we won't see the muon neutrinos except in neutral currents. So I don't know whether maybe Rick has some ideas on how to.
Well, furthermore, Dave, there's going to be one in your that professional lifetime in mind.
Yes, exactly. So I know that that George Fuller is interested in the R process, and he's interested in how neutrino oscillations affect the R process.
This could affect the R process.
So this effect, which works at 15, 30 kilometers from the center of the star, is relevant for the R process.
Okay. So. Can you see the phase if you have, for example, the beam is an equal mixture of the electron neutrino and mu neutrino, and the background is mu neutrino?
Say again?
To say, if you have inverted, instead of have mixing in the background,
yes.
You have mixing in the beam.
Yes.
And you see only mu neutrinos in the background.
Yes.
Is it equivalent?
Oh, no. Well, this is the point of the U2 symmetry. So you can. The problem is symmetric, right? You can say that I have let the beam have the superposition state and the background be some flavor. The logic is exactly the same. So you go through the same. So given the basis, you can write the standard evolution equation for that basis and send a beam of a certain flavor and see how it evolves. But the physics is the same. I mean, it doesn't matter what states you label like nu e and what states you label like nu x. At some point, you can just rotate everything, and the argument does not change. So anyway, the bottom line is that people who applied the standard equation can sleep well, but they were sleeping well even before this, so it's okay. But what was surprising to us is that this kind of an argument was not known to the people who created the equations. So we talked to both Jim Pantaleone and Georg Graffold about this. And other, this wouldn't, I wouldn't have given the talk if it wasn't the input from them.